Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ever wonder what opera singers are thinking about while they're standing around waiting to sing? If you see Lawrence Brownlee out on stage at the Met, and it's football season, you can pretty well guess what he's thinking.
I'll come off the stage and see how my team is doing, and then probably be either happy or upset or nervous and go back on the stage. And the whole time I'm singing, I'm thinking, I hope Peyton Manning threw two touchdowns or something like that.
Well, seems to work for Lawrence, who is now one of the most sought-after tenors in American opera. But he's also a rabid football fan and Twitter-tweeter. He does that between arias, too. Meet the opera singer who's almost too busy to sing later on Soundcheck. But first, can I interest you in a 1965 Chevrolet Corvair? No? Well, maybe this will change your mind.
We're sure to make Joysville, while all of the rest are hopelessly square. So take a tip from the all-time hipster, the car with a flair. It's the all-new 65 Corvair, I mean the brand-new 65 Corvair, I mean the 65.
Yes, that rousing number comes from a 1965 musical made to announce the new models of Chevrolet cars. Who made it? Why? And perhaps most important, why are we listening to it now? The answers to all these questions will be revealed when Steve Young, veteran writer for The Late Show with David Letterman, joins us in the Soundcheck studio. And now, the Olympics are coming to Sochi, Russia, and we're gearing up all this week by looking at the music and cultural scene in Russia, past and present. And because we couldn't think of what else to call it, we call it From Russia with Soundcheck.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Just to be clear, we haven't gone anywhere. We're still here in our New York studio. But we do have boots on the ground in Moscow, and we'll start with Michael Idov from Moscow via Skype. Michael, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John.
Now, I know you moved to Moscow from New York a couple of years ago. From the time that you've spent there, what are the big differences that you see between the pop music stars in Russia and the ones here in America?
Well, you know, pop music and pop scene in general are supposed to be getting increasingly fractured with the various sort of groups finding their own megastars. But boy, is it true about Russia. The scene is really fractured here. And it's fractured by age and it's fractured by class, which is interesting. The biggest stars in Russia, the ones that make it to the, you know, the Forbes top five entertainers in the country, et cetera, are, you know, Stas Mikhailov, Vyanga, and Grigory Lips, who, by the way, was recently called a persona non grata by the U.S. government for some shady dealings. So he's denied a visa for life.
not because we don't approve of his music, but because of other things.
Well, if you heard his music, you might have added that to the list of charges. All these three people really, really appeal to the 40-something, 50-something women demographic. And that demographic is huge enough and spendy enough.
Yeah, has the purchasing power.
To actually make them incredibly wealthy and very busy concert-wise.
So that is very unusual because here in the States, the 40-plus women's audience is not the target demographic of pop stars. They're going much, much younger.
Right. Well, obviously, the big Western pop stars are also, you know, also very popular in Russia. Rihanna is huge here. Katy Perry is huge, et cetera, et cetera. And the Russians have a very sort of very melodic sense of what, you know, their sense of what they find appealing is very much based on melody more so than a beat or a groove.
Right,
for example, that's just the legacy of the, you know, the music they grew up with. But the main thing you need to know about the young people in Russia is that they get all their music through a social network called VKontakte, which is a clone of Facebook,
right?
More or less, with one huge distinction. It has a built-in music player where you can pretty much listen to, you know, and stream just about everything that everybody else is listening to on that social network. Yeah, it's completely, you know, illegal in a certain aspect, but it's basically a peer-to-peer network built into a social network, which is brilliant. You know, you don't download these things, you just stream them, but they're right there at your fingertips, 24/7. Where all the music has gone. So the Russian, you know, the Russian music scene has gotten to the point where probably the, you know, the all of the music industry is heading to, which is basically an album or a recording is just an ad for your live show.
Right, right. We're speaking with Michael Idov, the author and editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. Do young people in Russia have things like MTV? Is there a Russian version of American Idol or The Voice or anything like that?
All of the above, actually.
Really?
Yes, there's MTV. There's a homegrown channel called Music TV, which is an MTV by any other name. Mm-hmm. There's a homegrown licensed version of The Voice called Golos, which is the Russian for, you guessed it, The Voice. And it's a huge hit. There's a homegrown American Idol, which in itself is, of course, a franchise of a British show called Pop Idol. Right. So they've got that, too. All of these things are there, and they create stars just like their American and generally Western counterparts do. For example, Nyusha is a huge star, a pop star appealing to maybe a slightly younger demographic.
What was the name of that person again?
Nyusha.
Nyusha.
Nyusha is actually a diminutive from Anne, Anna.
Okay. And so she's one of the bright young stars for Russia today.
Yeah, but also you have to remember that in Russia, no star is ever washed up. I've always gotten a kick out of it. Every time I would come to Russia, I would see these ads for, you know, various members of ABBA and AHA and, you know, Boney M. And they're all here, you know, Scorpions, you know, Deep Purple. Russia is an alternative universe where all these guys are still huge stars. And the homegrown stars are like that, too. There's a woman named Natalie who was a big star about 20 years ago. And this year she's had an enormous hit that basically you could hear coming out of every radio, every car, et cetera, in the country, called "Oh My God, What a Man."
Now, why would Russia be such a haven for musicians who would otherwise be, you know, consigned to the dustbin of history elsewhere?
This is actually a more serious question than it would appear to be. I think it's because Russia generally runs on a kind of conflicted nostalgia. That's the thing about the Russian culture, you know? Mm. Because they alternately remember the Soviet years as kind of a golden age or as a kind of hell, but they can't help but keep returning to these years for inspiration or for nostalgia or for just generally sort of to remember a time where things were maybe bad but predictable.
Right.
So everyone who was big here in 1985 is pretty much still big here.
Michael Idov with us from Moscow via Skype. He's editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. Now, Michael, you've written about the Williamsburg scene here in New York, you know, the indie rock hipster scene, as being really, really important and influential there in Moscow. How does that show itself? How does that manifest?
You know, it's not just the music scene. I think it's the whole package. It's, you know, it's the look and it's the food and it's this sort of homegrown aesthetic. I would actually argue that the music is one of the few things that didn't quite fire up the imaginations of the young Russians or Moscovites as much as, for example, the Williamsburg approach to food. Honestly, it's more of a food revolution than a music one. But, you know, in the 80s, the Russian rock scene was really interesting because it was homegrown and sort of lo-fi by necessity. You know, in their minds, these guys sounded like Pink Floyd, but the truth was they were recording on, you know, four tracks. And funny thing is now these recordings, whether they meant to or not, sound really cool and really current because of these limitations. But now a lot of the Russian young Russian acts, they sound exactly like their British and American counterparts. And it makes them a little less interesting, to be honest.
Well, you know, we've seen plenty of examples of that throughout music history around the world. People from one culture or country trying to sound like another and in the process accidentally inventing their own thing. You know, you think of reggae in Jamaica, for example. So take us back to the rock scene in the 1980s. Who's a band that, you know, might have thought they were sounding like Pink Floyd, but to our ears now sound completely different and uniquely Russian?
Well, one band that I absolutely adore that I grew up on is this band called Kino. And they sort of tried to sound like the Smiths on their third album, which was called This Is Not Love. But they had, you know, they didn't have a drummer, so they used this dinky drum machine and two acoustic guitars and a really virtuosic bass to sort of fill in all the, you know, all the empty spaces. And as a result, the album sounds like something that could have been recorded in only two places and times in the human history, either, you know, in Russia in 1985 or in Williamsburg in 2007. Ты звонишь мне каждый день. Я не знаю, как мне быть. Я не знаю, как мне дать тебе понять, что я уже не тот. Раньше я тебя любил. Сердце больше не поет, и с момента нашей первой встречи скоро будет целый год. Ты выглядишь так несовременно рядом со мной. Ты выглядишь так несовременно рядом со мной. That's the Russian band Kino from the 1980s. Michael Idov, editor-in-chief of GQ Russia, is giving us a whirlwind tour of the Russian music scene, the pop music scene. What about Western groups? You mentioned before Katy Perry, Rihanna, they're big there as well. I mean, does your top 40 chart in Moscow look like our top 40 chart in New York? Pretty much. I mean, it looks more like the British top 40 chart for a few obvious reasons, you know. But But yeah, I wouldn't say it's that different.
Okay.
And again, sorry.
Then my follow-up is, does the Moscow Top 40 look the same as the Vladivostok Top 40? I mean, it's the same country, but you're separated by, like, what, 10 time zones?
That's a great question. And no, it probably does not. Funny that you should mention Vladivostok, because that's the birthplace of one of the best Russian rock bands, probably the best Russian rock band of the 90s, still working today, called Mumy Troll. A big fan of these guys. They started out with a sort of a Britpop sound that actually kind of prefigured Britpop in many ways, because they were playing this sort of stuff since the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And they are definitely the creation of Vladivostok. The one thing also that I think bears mentioning is that while the Russian culture generally emanates from Moscow in a lot of ways, the rock culture, especially in the 80s and the 90s, was really decentralized and still is. A lot of the best rock music came out of Sverdlovsk, now Yekaterinburg. And as I said, Mumy Troll were from Vladivostok. And Zemfira, this sort of pop alternative diva that the young people really love, I think. She's from Ufa, which is also just deeply, deeply provincial city. And, of course, the Russian rap scene is really powerful. In fact, one could make a case that the Russians really took to rap much easier and do a much better job of it than they did with rock music. And that one is that is also really decentralized and coming from all over the place.
Do you have a favorite example of Russian hip-hop?
Well, I personally really love this very literate, sort of hyper-articulate guy named Oxymiron, who spent a few years in the UK and started out doing some sort of Russian language grime music, which I think it's the best thing in Russian hip-hop right now. Из кладовок, антресолей и полуподвалов, из переходов, что познали баллоны вандалов, офисных окон, где я пробыл рабом феодалов. Я что-то тихо вынес, ночами заныкал, и пока начальник мне не скажет с вещами на выход. На выход, блядь! Ты, как всегда, опечалишь барыгу, взяв то, что толкает англичанин с очами на выход. Мне подождать и подножать или уйти, чтобы это дальше продолжали подражать. Или несу хуйню, и они безропотно вторят. Но в итоге кто ученый, а кто подопытный кролик? Мне нужен врач. Oxymiron is the name of that example of Russian hip-hop suggested for us by Michael Idoff, editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. And any other cultural phenomena there in Russia that we should know about as we start to hear more about Sochi and the Olympics and Russia in general? Well, we still don't know what the musical program in Sochi is going to be, but assumes that it's going to be pretty conservative and not very adventurous in nature. But it's funny because earlier today, there was this great hoax that sort of took off like wildfire on the Russian internet that supposedly the band Tattoo were going to play at the opening ceremony. And wouldn't that be great? Because
we saw that on our internet as well today, that the Tattoo. Right. Now, they're a rare example of a Russian pop band that actually made it to the West about 10 years or so ago.
True, and, you know, I think they were damn good, actually, as a pop band. Honestly, they had great songs.
And so are you saying that now the sense is that this was a hoax and they will not be playing?
No, it has been confirmed as a hoax. They're not going to be playing. And, of course, it's a measure of how far Russia has gone in the way of you know, conservatism and just shutting itself in and just basically going backward culturally over the last few years, that, you know, 10 years ago, nobody here raised an eyebrow, or people raised eyebrows, but, you know, that was it, about the notion of a band marketing itself as, you know, a same-sex teenage duo of girls who are, you know, assumed to be lovers.
Right.
And, of course, now it's not just inconceivable, it is actually illegal.
Illegal, yes. Yeah, which is one of the big talking points of this year's Olympics. Michael Idov is editor-in-chief of GQ Russia. He's been Skyping in with us here on the Soundcheck studio from Moscow in advance of the Olympics in Sochi and giving us a whirlwind tour of Russian popular music. Michael, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen. Нас не догонят дальше от них, дальше от дома. Ночь проводник, спрячем наши тени за облака, за облаками.
Steve Young is a mild-mannered writer for The Late Show with David Letterman, but he also happens to have a massive collection of so-called industrial musicals. Find out what an industrial musical is. Fair warning, the songs are very catchy. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Want to play something for you? It's from a 1964 musical, sort of.
What a thrill to sell an automobile, especially a Dodge.
Sounds like it's from an old Broadway show, doesn't it? What a thrill to sell an automobile. Maybe it's the cast recording from some long-lost musical about car salesmen. But then you hear that next line, especially a Dodge, and something smells funny. Turns out this is no ordinary musical, it's an industrial musical. Tons of these things were composed in the mid-20th century at the behest of major American corporations. And now those extremely flattering songs are the subject of a new book called Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals by Steve Young and Sport Murphy. Steve joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Welcome.
Hello, John. Thank you.
So industrial musicals, are they just what they sound like?
They are musicals that bear a startling resemblance to popular entertainments that would be on a Broadway stage, but they were never for the public to hear. They were only at sales meetings and conventions for the education and entertainment of company insiders, the sales force, distributors, and so on.
And were they called industrial musicals, or is that a term you guys coined?
Well, you had a lot of slang. Some people called them just industrials in general, and that might encompass films and other little dramatic presentations. Industrial shows, you often hear industrial musicals. Sometimes they were called business theater. That may have been a term the Equity Actors Union, I think, may have had that as their official designation. But it was all the same thing. It was a whole galaxy of entertainment that was just out of sight, out of mind for the American public, unless you were somebody going to one of these conventions.
Right. Now, as you say, it's a whole galaxy, and we can't cover a whole galaxy. So in the interest of narrowing our focus here, we're going to look at cars, the automobile industry.
Right. These shows encompassed pretty much everything that American business was doing, whether it's insurance or typewriters, soda, appliances, tractors. But the car industry was one of the early and always very strong creators of these shows, because every year, late summer, early fall, you had a new line of cars coming out. And it was, in those days, really anticipated by the public. Oh, what will the new Cadillac look like? Oh, my God, what sort of new engine will we have in the new Chevy Impala? So late summer, early fall, all the dealers for the entire corporation, the car companies, would attend these unveilings, these announcement shows. And it was very dramatic, because you'd have speeches, of course, and, oh, it's going to be a great year. But everybody was waiting for the big reveal of what are the new cars actually going to look like? Are we going to fall in love with them? And they just whipped the audience into a frenzy with these shows that were very beautifully crafted. They were spending millions, literally millions of dollars in these days on these shows that would have a plot about a salesman who's nervous about his future, and then he learns that the company is behind him and he's going to have a great year because, oh my God, look at the new Plymouth, it's gorgeous, and oh, I can't wait to get out there and sell it. And they were very, very well done, and they would send people out into the field with a new spring in their step, and boy, I can't wait to get back to my own dealership and tell the folks about the 100 new features of the Ford Falcon.
Don't Let a B-Back Get Away is the name of this number from a 1960 Oldsmobile show called Who Could Ask for Anything More?
No, 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 no. Don't let her be back. No, no. Don't let her be back. No, 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 no. Don't let her be back. Get away.
I'll be back.
Why are you leaving?
I don't know. Thought I'd go. I'll be back.
From one of the industrial musicals from the folks at Oldsmobile in 1960, a dealer announcement show called Who Could Ask for Anything More? Don't Let a Be-Back Get Away. Be-backs were, I guess, the bane of dealers.
That's
everywhere.
Right. They're kind of browsing and thinking, yeah, I'm not really ready to pull the trigger on
I'll
anything.
I'll be back.
Right. So this was, as I think you know, a name that you would recognize, actually, in this show.
The singer there is Florence Henderson,
that's
who would
right.
later be Mrs. Brady.
Yes, a decade later. But she started out in the mid-50s on Broadway in New York and was doing quite well. Then she got married, started to have children. She was not really up for a full Broadway gig, but an Oldsmobile producer who knew her saw her and said one day, oh, would you be interested in doing sort of a short-term gig? That we could make it very pleasant for you. And she ended up doing, like, I think of four or five of these Oldsmobile dealer announcement shows.
They were probably pretty well-paying gigs, I would think.
Oh, you got excellent accommodations. You got a good paycheck. She got to borrow Oldsmobile cars for free and just take them out whenever she wanted to. And, yeah, she recalls just the whole experience was extremely pleasant. And the shows, as you can hear, had the scent of money and talent all over them.
The production values are almost, you know, they're Hollywood level.
Yeah.
And Luther Henderson, no relation to Florence.
No relation, although they were booked into the same hotel room mistakenly many times. That was a bit awkward, she said. But, yeah, you had people who were moving back and forth constantly between the quote-unquote real Broadway world and these shows, which at the upper level were absolutely the same kind of talent. And you had big orchestras, full
right.
cast, scenery, props, a story. It was satisfying work. You just had to be prepared for the fact that it might play one night to a group of 500 people in an auditorium and it would never be heard of again. Some of them were pressed on these souvenir records, and that's how we've kind of found our way into these lost worlds of these shows.
Steve Young is a co-author of Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, along with writer and musician Sport Murphy. He's also a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman. The book's out now, and you also have a three-volume set of these songs out on iTunes.
Yeah, we find, not to anyone's surprise, if you put together this beautiful book and say how interesting and weirdly beautiful and surprising these songs are, people want to hear them.
Yeah.
And we do have a website, industrialmusicals.com, where we've put up a sort of appetizer course of some of our favorites on streaming audio. But now we also have on iTunes 50s, 60s, and 70s greatest hits. We've got about, it's close to 70 songs total, and it really will, it'll remake the chemistry in your brain, and you'll never be the same again. You'll find yourself singing these songs to yourself because...
And possibly buying a car.
Yeah, they're not just weird. The best of them are just fantastically good songs.
Well, let's hear a medley of three different songs from a recording called Music from AM Route 66. This is American Motors. We're sort of focusing on the car industry in our survey of industrial musicals. And music here by Hank Beebe, another guy who had like a real music career.
Five, four. Look out, big tree, here we come.
One, four, five, feet. They better watch out for you and me. From now on, my friendly giant killers, friendly giant killers. From now on, that's what we are.
Step in, get them all to step out. In step with the times.
With the
car that's on the move, the car that's out to prove. AM step to the times.
And you are a doing the ambassador. Doing the ambassador.
Once in a while, we get to see a great car. That's what you've come to be. A great car, you're big.
beautiful ambassador.
Oh, my God. I'm ready to buy an American Motors ambassador.
Well,
if only there were such a thing still.
I think the shows from this era that American Motors did were more exciting than their cars. That was the danger. The big three were always kind of the leaders, and American Motors was running along behind them. But you wouldn't know
the
it
friendly
from these,
giant killers, as they say
right,
in the first of those
gonna
songs.
They're going to knock off GM, Ford, and Chrysler with their new lineup.
Soundcheck listeners, have you ever experienced one of these industrial musicals? And I'm looking at you folks, WDET Detroit listeners, since we're focusing on the car industry right now. Tell us about your experience with industrial musicals. Leave a comment on soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Again, that's soundcheck.org or 866-939-1612. Steve Young is with me on Soundcheck. Along with Sport Murphy, he is the author of Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. Find some of these songs on Steve's site, industrialmusicals.com. These things, you said they were meant for a specific audience in the car industry. Were any of them ever like pressed up and made available to people?
The souvenir records were really only for the use of people who'd been to these events. These were internal corporate communications. The public was not allowed into these shows. The public was not given a chance to get these souvenir records. So they're extremely rare for the most part. If the car company pressed up a couple thousand copies of something, that's pretty rare by record collecting standards, I think. And also, we find most of them are not very well played. Most of them didn't get much use.
People
brought them home and said, huh, that's interesting, and put them in a closet. And then 40 years later, I buy them on eBay in nearly mint condition oftentimes. Surely many of the copies of these records must have been immediately thrown away. They were just seen as, well, that's a curious thing, but I don't really see myself gathering the family in the living room to listen to the hit tunes from the 1957 Ford introduction show. As much as I might crave that experience, I'm a little different coming to it from a different perspective.
Well, you came to this as part of writing for David Letterman, right, for the segment they call Dave's Record Collection.
That's right. It was about 20 years ago. I was a relatively new writer on the staff. I had been asked to head up Dave's record collection, which was actual records Dave would hold up. We'd hear a little clip. He'd have a joke. I was going out to record stores looking for strange, unintentionally funny records that we could get a little clip out of and get a laugh from. I started coming back from these stores. In those days, there were some record stores. You could actually paw through the miscellaneous bins. And I would come back with these things, Diesel Dazzle, My Insurance Man, music from AM Route 66 was one of the early ones I found. I didn't really know what this was. It was just something to make fun of. But then when I realized, oh, the record collection bit was on a week ago, I'm still singing this song about big and beautiful, bold and beautiful, we're sold on you, beautiful ambassador. These things were sticking in my head, and I started to pursue it for myself and interviewing people that I could track down.
Now, the one we're going to hear next, We're Thinking of You, this is, as far as we know, the only copy in the world that has come to light?
That's right. There must be so many shows out there that I don't know yet that exist in such rare form that somebody's got the single copy of something somewhere. I know of some records like that. I have what I believe to be the only copy in existence currently known of the 62 Cadillac introduction show. It's got a test pressing label. It's got a crude handmade cover. They may have only pressed up some handful of copies to give to the top executives or something. I was very lucky to get this from a dealer who knows what I am interested in. And I didn't expect much from it. I thought, well, this looks like a piece of junk. And I put the needle down on the record. And, oh, my God, this is one of the top pieces in the genre. This Cadillac, they were restrained. They didn't have the bombastic orchestra. They have a wonderful little jazzy combo, and it's recorded beautifully. And it came so close to just never being heard again.
Dottie, we've got to get after those car owners we haven't serviced in 2 or 3 years. You know, sometimes all it takes is just a little effort on our part to regain their business.
Let's start digging into all those old dusty files. Find the people we ain't seen for 10,000 miles.
Old acquaintances renew. Call them up, say, this is Lou. How's that car of yours behaving? We're thinking of you. Let's be sure we're going after, not just the new. Check on all those runabouts from 1902. Ask them for an interview. Tell them what we'd like to do is keep your car in top condition. We're thinking of you.
Service, service, let's remember.
We're thinking of you, the 1962 Cadillac dealer show called The Most Fabulous Year. The only copy of this record known is the one that that belongs in the collection of Steve Young, who's co-author of Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. He's here with me on Soundcheck. As long as we're talking about these cars, I want to give people a chance to hear, Steve, some of the other things from your record collection.
Right. Well, there's no shortage of them. The car companies, as I say, were a huge part of the industrial musical field for a long time.
The industrial musical complex?
That's it. The military industrial musical complex.
All right, so here are some musicals created for specific models of cars, beginning with the Chevy Corvair.
Out in outer space, this baby's got class.
We're sure to make Joysville, while all of the rest are hopelessly square. So take a tip from the all-time hipster, the car with a flair. It's the all-new 65 Corvair, I mean the brand-new 65 Corvair, I mean the 65.
You mean it's got style?
And here's the Oldsmobile 88 and 98 with the so-called rocket engine.
Now let's talk about a rocket, my friend. I'm in a rocket engine Oldsmobile. A rocket engine is found in the 88 Super 88 and the 98 Oldsmobile.
Wait, I say, wait a minute there, friend. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Come again.
Oh, I see. I got to differentiate. The 88 is for economy. The Super 88 for glamour and go. The 98 is for luxury and room.
I see.
And they all spell Olds with a capital O-L-D-S. That's O.
And an industrial musical celebrating the 1970 Dodge Charger.
It's a charging charger.
Put this charger up against competitors, then call all the nation's leading editors. Just let them pick their own glowing metaphors.
Charger charges on.
What it can't do ain't worth doing.
It's a charging charger.
Once inside, always something new in.
Every charging charger.
And finally, the Audi 4000. From Born Again, a 1979 industrial musical.
Oh, I feel excitement in the air. People are talking, and you can hear it everywhere. The word's out, and it's sweeping.
Wow. So that, Steve, that's 1979.
Yeah, this is fairly late in terms of my collection. Certainly by the mid-80s, vinyl records were starting to be on their way out, and that's been the core of my collection is the vinyl souvenir records.
So what happened to industrial musicals? I mean, obviously, they were still being made in 1979. When did they stop?
They did continue in roughly what we would consider the same form for a while. I think I have some material on cassette from the late 80s, maybe the early 90s. But several things were changing by the 80s. Number one, they were no longer new. People had gotten used to this form of entertainment at conventions. In the 50s, it was, oh, my God, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard, a whole musical about the new Oldsmobile. And by the 80s, it was, yeah, another one of those shows.
Right. Okay.
There were new technologies that allowed people to put on flashy presentations without hiring a composer and a 40-person orchestra.
Yeah,
and so on. Audio-visual materials, reusable songs that could be customized with minor amounts of lyrics being changed and big things on screens and laser lights and so on. You also just, I think the car companies especially have changed how they roll out their models. You now see new models coming out at different times of the year and being introduced to the public at public car shows like the Detroit Auto Show or New York Auto Show, there's not that big drum roll at the end of the summer of, all right, folks, here we go. We're going to pull the tarp off the
right.
brand new 63 Ford Galaxy. There isn't that cathartic moment every year like there used to be. But there were these shows continuing into the 80s and probably beyond, and I'm sure there are still company events and meetings, and there must be some form of music playing. But nobody, from what I can tell, with very few exceptions, is still paying the big bucks for a full musical.
Steve Young is co-author of the book Everything's Coming Up, Profits, the Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, along with writer and musician Sport Murphy. He's also a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman. And check out the website industrialmusicals.com to hear more of these songs from the auto industry and beyond. And Steve, a favorite in our office, This Is the Edsel.
Oh,
so we're gonna go out with a little bit of
all
that.
Right, that's so sad. They were so optimistic in the summer of 1957. Ford Motor Company's new division, it's going to turn the industry on its head. What a great car. You're all so lucky to be involved with this organization. I like to imagine late 1959 when Ford has shut down the Edsel division. Some embittered Edsel dealer sitting in his office late at night listening to this souvenir record album and just drinking whiskey straight from the bottle.
This is the Edsel, an American original.
Now that the football season is officially over, NFL players out there might have some spare time on their hands. They might consider following in the footsteps of Lawrence Brownlee, the former college football player turned operatic tenor. Brownlee joins us to perform a set of spirituals next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Lawrence Brownlee may be one of the most in-demand tenors on the American opera scene, but his job does not define him as a person. Yes, he loves opera, but he also loves salsa dancing, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Boston Celtics, and apparently Twitter. In fact, he seems to like Twitter a lot, as we'll see. His latest album is called Spiritual Sketches, done with the pianist and composer Damien Sneed. They describe it as a love letter to the tradition of African-American spirituals, but it's also an extension of that tradition. Here's Lawrence Brownlee and Damien Sneed at our piano to play one for us, Every Time I Feel the Spirit, live on Soundcheck.
Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Upon the mountain, my Lord spoke. Out of his mouth came fire and smoke. Look around me, look so fine. Ask the Lord, could it be mine? Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Jordan River, chilly and cold, chilled the body but not the soul. Looked around me, looked so fine. Ask the Lord, could it be mine? Every time I feel the Spirit moving in my heart, I will pray. Every time I feel the Spirit
I will pray. I have sorrow, I have woe, I have heartache here below. While God leads me, I won't fear, for I know that He is near.
That is Lawrence Brownlee, Shattering Glass, in the Soundcheck studio with Every Time I Feel the Spirit, and Damien Sneed at the piano live on Soundcheck. That song is part of the new album, the most recent album, called Spiritual Sketches. Lawrence, good to have you back with
us. Thank you, John. It's good to be back with you.
Damien, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
That sound almost sounded like a spiritual with, I don't know, Ahmad Jamal or somebody like that accompanying me. It's like very different from the kind of operatic tradition of, you know, African-American singers standing and delivering in a kind of classical vein. Is that what you were going for here?
Well, yeah. When Damien and I met, we met about 2 years ago, I think it was, I wanted to present something that showed my whole musical education. And so Damien also had the same background. And So
are you actually playing around with the original kind of accompaniments that a John Jacob Niles or one of those people would have originally done for these old spirituals?
Most definitely. Those are definitely, for me personally, the first time I really experienced this was with Kathleen Battle and Jesse Norman. They did arrangements and orchestrated it for the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. And so I'm pulling some of that those ideas, of course, with Burley, Harry T. Burley, as you said, mm-hmm. Jacob Niles, mm-hmm. right. and just infusing it with what feels right and what right. feels appropriate. Mm-hmm.
So now, Lawrence, you've been getting a lot of really great lead roles from the Met here in New York to the L.A. Opera on the other coast.
Right.
Including roles that have not traditionally gone to African-American
Absolutely.
Men. The Sopranos, you know, the Leontine Prices and the Jesse Normans, they've had that trail blazed for them. You're still kind of doing that on the male side of things, it
Yes,
seems.
I consider myself very fortunate, and I've had so many doors open to me. I've gotten a chance to meet George Shirley, who was one of the first ones. You know, a lot of people, a lot of the younger singers will say, you're a role model to me. And But I always say to people like George Shirley that you are the one who kicked down the door. And even the singers like Marian Anderson, Leontine Price, Martina Arroyo, all those people who came before us, they also were a big part of opening the doors that we today can perform and be on these stages.
I'll throw in another name, Robert McFerrin.
Absolutely.
Bobby McFerrin's dad,
Absolutely.
Who was the first African-American male singer to get a contract.
Absolutely,
with
at the Metropolitan
Opera.
Opera, right. Camilla Williams, there are many, many that, you know, were important for us today.
Now, let me ask you about this L.A. debut, the Magic Flute, because you were apparently tweeting from the wings. Let me read. Through die Bildnis already, wie stark coming up now. Here we go. So what is happening here? You're walking off stage, grabbing your phone, sending out tweets, and then going back out to sing the next aria?
Right. I mean, especially fantasy football season. Fantasy football season,
really?
I'll come off the stage and see how my team is doing. And then probably be either happy or upset or nervous and go back on the stage. And the whole time I'm singing, I'm thinking, I hope Peyton Manning threw 2 touchdowns or something like that.
Now, can you use that in your character, you know?
Of course, depending on where it is in the opera, I could really be upset in a point if my team's losing. So I have one fantasy championship this year, though, so I'm happy.
Really?
Yes.
How many different leagues are you in?
My wife hates the fall. I do about this year I did 4 leagues, which is, I know it's crazy, but it's really fun.
That is crazy.
Yes.
That is crazy. And you're jetting around from Europe to America and back. Such is the life, apparently, of the professional opera singer, Lawrence Brownlee, with us here on Soundcheck today. Just for folks who have not seen Lawrence's Twitter page, this is what it says. Professional opera singer with many hobbies, including salsa dancing, photography, and following the Steelers and Celtics. I am also a noop. N-U-P-E. What is a noop?
What is a noop? If I tell you, no.
You'll have to kill me?
I have to kill you. No. I am a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated, and we call ourselves Newt.
All right. I thought that might be it.
Right.
So I looked it up on the internet and found this series of statements about noobs, and you can stop me when these begin to get when you think it's not right. Number one, noobs are college educated.
They are, yes.
Number two, noobs are overachievers.
Yes, we are.
Number three, noobs are entitled to your girl. I'm not making this up.
I didn't write that, but there's probably a shred of truth in that. No, I'm joking.
Given that your wife is just outside the studio, I'm going to go straight to number four because it might come in handy. Number four, noobs can talk their way out of any situation.
That is absolutely
correct. I am eager to see you talk your way out of this one when we get
out
of here.
My wife knows that I love her.
Number five, noobs are cocky, conceited, and confident.
I don't think all of that. We're confident, you know. We're
okay.
Confident.
And the final one, noobs will be noobs, so approach with caution.
Someone
right
was
off the
brilliant
internet, baby.
In writing those things. And so I'm very proud of them, of my fraternity.
All right. I'm going to cautiously ask you to sing another song for us. Great old. You want to do Balm and Gilead? This is
sure.
One that that we've
that
heard
sounds
for
like a good one.
Many, many years, but perhaps not in this arrangement. Lawrence Brownlee, the tenor, Damian Sneed at the piano. Their collaborative record is called Spiritual Sketches. They are playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Here's a live performance of Balm in Gilead.
Thank you.
Balm in Gilead, the name of that great old spiritual, sung live on soundcheck by Lawrence Brownlee, Damien Sneed performing at our piano from their collaborative record called Spiritual Sketches. All right, now, Lawrence, are you back at the Met anytime soon?
I am, actually. I get a chance to come back in April. I'll be doing I Puritani.
Okay.
So it'll be my first Bellini at the Met, and so now I've done Rossini and Donizetti, and now moving on to Bellini.
Hitting
so.
all the high notes in the bel canto repertoire, in a manner of speaking.
All the Eenies are almost done, so I need to find someone else to sing at a certain point.
All the Eenies. That's a good one. All right. Lawrence Brownlee, the tenor, Damien Sneed, the pianist. The record is called Spiritual Sketches. Guys, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us, John.
If you enjoyed our session with Lawrence Brownlee, there's more where this came from. Hear an additional song at soundcheck.org.
From Russia. With love.
All this week on the show, we're talking about music and Russia in the countdown to the Olympics in Sochi. We call it From Russia with Soundcheck. And tomorrow, Gary Steingart joins us with a Pick 3 playlist inspired by Little Failure, his comic memoir about his Russian-American family, which left Leningrad in 1979. And an exclusive preview of new songs by the guitar pop band Real Estate. Their new album, Atlas, doesn't come out till March, but you can hear new songs from it tomorrow. And if you can't wait, you can hear the session now on soundcheck.org. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.